Hi, my name is Paul, and I'm a member with Restored Church. If you're new, we want to welcome you and thank you for tuning in. We believe that the church is not an event, but a family that you belong to, so we'd love the opportunity to connect with you. If you want to learn more about our church or if we can help you in any way, please visit our website, restoredtemecula.church, and click on Contact. We also have a mobile app with resources, including our Sunday messages, information about upcoming events, and other ways to connect. You can download our app on Apple or Android app stores. With all that said, we hope you enjoy the message.
It's good to be with you guys this morning. If I haven't had a chance to meet you, my name is Herrick. I am one of the elders here of Restored Temecula, and it's good to be with you. And this morning, I have the privilege of continuing a series that we've been in for a few years now called The King and His Kingdom. And we've been going through the Gospel of Matthew. And if you're new, we're so glad that you're here. The Gospel of Matthew is one of the accounts of the life of Jesus of Nazareth, as told by one of the eyewitnesses to his life. And it is full of rich teaching, history of what Jesus did, what he said, and what it all means. And so we have been working through this Gospel now for a while. And we're about halfway, just over halfway done with it. So sometime this decade we'll finish, and it's going to be great. But for now, we're going to actually, this might be the shortest text of my life that I've ever preached. I'm just going to cover three verses, technically. And so I'm excited to share this with you. I've been stewing on this all week, and I've had a lot of fun with the parables. Anybody else enjoying the parables so far? Yep, three of us. Terrific. So hopefully there'll be four or five of us after today, but I'm going to go ahead and pray, if you'll join me in praying that God would open up our eyes and our ears and our hearts to what he has to say this morning. Father, we want to thank you for this morning. We want to thank you that you are true, that you are good, that you are gracious, and we want to thank you that you sent your son to reveal what you're like to us. In the face of Jesus, we see you. And we just want to thank you for this morning that we get to sit with the words of Jesus. And we want to ask God that you would open up our eyes and our ears and our hearts to receive, to see, to hear, to taste and see that the Lord is good. I pray that you would speak to each person here individually. I can't possibly know everything that's going on in everybody's lives, but you do. You know every single person. You know what every person is going through, and I pray that by your Spirit you would press the words of Jesus upon our hearts in ways that speak to each of us individually, far beyond what I can do. Thank you for the privilege of opening up your word. God, I never want to take it for granted. God, we love you, we honor you, and it's in your son's name we pray. Amen. Amen. Let me grab my notebook. As I was thinking about today's message, I was reminded of a very interesting time in my life. I was 26 years old, 26 years old. I was living in San Diego at the time. I'm not originally from San Diego, but I did spend 15 years there. I went to college there, to a little school called USD, University of San Diego. Any Toreros in the house? Erica, what timing. All right, so there's two of us here. Very small school. Yeah, I went to undergrad. Erica did grad school there. Very small school in San Diego, beautiful place. And the sidewalks literally sparkled on that campus. It hooked me into San Diego forever. Not forever, 15 years, which feels like an eternity to some of you. It's longer than you've been alive. And I decided after college in San Diego, like, I got to stay here. No matter what it costs me, I need to stay. I lived in Orange County for several years. I lived in Puerto Rico before then. And so I decided to stay in San Diego. I got a job there. I worked at a law firm. And then sometime a few years later in 2010, on the weekend of 4th of July, I decided that it was time for me to find a wife. And so I signed up for eHarmony. Does everybody know what eHarmony is? Is it still a thing?
Yes.
All right, cool. And I did. I found me a wife. The end. No, there's more to the story. But so I met Heather online, don't know if you didn't know that. That's where we met. And we had our first date at Costa Brava in San Diego. It's a restaurant that's near and dear. I know there's some Costa Brava fans in the house. Near and dear to my heart, we had a five-hour date. Her roommate thought that she had been kidnapped by some random guy off the internet. But she hadn't. She had been swept off her feet by yours truly. And so thus begun a love story that has continued on to this day. But there have been a lot of ups and downs. But we went through this period where we had to figure out, are we going to stay together or not? And we decided that we were going to stay together. We got on the same page on some important things. And once we got on the same page on some really critical things, it was like, all right, I'm in. And so what I decided to do was I decided to buy a ring, since that's part of the process. And I don't know if you know this, but diamonds are expensive. And that was 2010. I can only imagine now with inflation and what's happened the last few years. So diamonds are pricey. And I was making not that much money. I worked at a law firm, but I'm not exactly a lawyer. I'm more of like the support staff for the guys that make real money. And so I knew that this something was going to have to give. And that for me to buy a ring with the kind of income I was pulling in, I was going to have to make some serious changes in my life. And so I had really gracious roommates, one of which I'm biologically related to, my twin brother Lewis, and my friend Nick, deep friend from many years before at USD. And I kind of concocted this idea that in order to save money to buy a ring, there weren't a lot of places I could either expand my income, but there was one place I could cut my spending. Any guesses where I cut my spending? Whoa. One at a time, people. In and out?
Eating out.
Eating out, okay. Any other ideas? Whoa. Sports? Not cutting that out. Somebody said rent. Marla, yes, rent. Rent was really expensive in San Diego. Again, I don't know what it's like now. And possibly expensive in UTC, which is the area we were looking in. And we were looking at three-bedroom apartments because there was three of us. I knew this is going to be the last place that I'm going to live until I get married. And so we looked at it and was like, hey, everything was so expensive. I wasn't going to be able to save anything. And so I was like, well, what if we just change the assumption? What if instead of looking for a three-bedroom, we look for a two-bedroom? And they're like, what do you mean? I was like, let's look for a two-bedroom with enough room for a couch that pulls out. And my one of them's biologically related. He doesn't have much of a choice. But my roommate Nick was super gracious. And he was like, all right, man, that's a little weird, but if that's what we got to do, like, we'll do that for you. First, we looked for lofts, for like a place with a loft. Couldn't find one. And so then we really focused on two-bedroom apartments. And so for the better part of, I don't remember how long, months, maybe over a year, my home was a closet and a couch. All my stuff was in a literal closet. I didn't have much, so that was fairly easy. And then I just slept on the couch. So the same couch that we'd like sit down and watch soccer games on, you'd be like, all right, good night, guys. I'd just pull out the couch, and that's exactly where I would sleep. And so for a while, I slept on a couch. And I was reflecting on that story this week because I think Jesus is going to talk to us this morning about exchanging lesser things for greater things. And for me, comfort didn't compare to covenant. And so I slept on the couch. And here's the thing. I did it gladly. It was a glad exchange so I could buy that ring. Heather, show them your ring. Don't do it. You can see it from far. It's literally sparkling right now. I gladly exchanged it, though. I had to put it. I was so nervous. I put it in a safety deposit box. Anybody ever had one of those? I didn't know that was a thing. Because obviously everything fit in a closet, so there was nothing of value in my life. But once I bought that ring, it was like, I got to put this somewhere safe. And so I went to the bank, and I was like, just keep this safe somewhere. And they gave me a key, and it was there until I was ready to give her the ring. Jesus offers us a glad exchange this morning for anybody that has eyes to see it, anybody that has ears to hear it, anybody whose heart's open. He's offering you something this morning that I don't think you're going to want to pass up on. So join me over in Matthew chapter 13, verses 44 to 46. Again, just going to do three verses this morning. It's not going to be a long, I could go long anytime, but it's going to be a little harder for me. It's already 10:50. Whatever. Let's go to the text. Matthew 13, 44 to 46. Jesus is teaching parables to his disciples. Parables are stories that reveal the kingdom for people who are open to it, and they conceal the kingdom for people who are hardened to Jesus' message. That's what they do. And they require sitting with them for a while. On occasion, Jesus does a great thing, and he'll be like, let me tell you what that meant, and it's recorded for us. He would do that with his disciples. We don't get the benefit of that one here. So we're going to have to do some work this morning. But ultimately, Jesus is speaking to disciples who he's asked much of. He's asked them to leave behind businesses. He's asked them to reprioritize him above even their own families. And so he's aware of the cost of following him. And so he gives these parables this morning to disciples like that. And I'm sure there's people in this room. I know many of you, many of your stories, you've given up much to follow Jesus. And he has, I think, something good for you here. Let's read. The kingdom of heaven is like a treasure, or like treasure, buried in a field that a man found and reburied. Then in his joy, underscore joy, he goes and sells everything he has and buys that field. Again, verse 45, the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant in search of fine pearls. When he found one priceless pearl, he went and sold everything he had and bought it. Those are our verses for this morning. Let's start talking by discussing treasure. So if you're taking notes, first thing we talk about, treasure. So verse 44, kingdom of heaven is like treasure buried in a field that a man found and reburied. Okay, so given widespread poverty in antiquity, it's no surprise that stories of buried treasure were really popular. People sometimes stored their wealth by burying it in a strong box, sometimes under the floor of their home. I recently read a story about a guy who they were like demoing a house, and he found a packet of baseball cards from the early 1950s that had never been opened. And there was a slight chance that in those baseball cards, there could be cards in there worth hundreds of thousands, possibly more money in it. So there's sometimes in our world, even today, we find kind of buried treasure. And it makes the news, you know, like this story that I saw was on the news. And there were stories that were told in antiquity around this kind of idea because people really suffered through excruciating poverty. And so they had stories about finding or running into wealth that were really popular, which is not surprising. This would be sort of like if you grow up and you're struggling financially, this would be kind of like hearing about someone who found a lottery ticket that actually had the winning numbers on it. Or maybe somebody finding something, for those of you that are into like garage sales, like finding like some kind of rare item in a garage sale that's worth a lot of money. Some of you probably dream about this, right? Or maybe finding an incredible deal when you're going out shopping. It's like you find something that whatever it costs, it's going to be worth it to you to secure it, to grab hold of that. And I want to play a little game called Would You Rather? Okay? I'm not going to have anybody stand up. I'm going to ask some questions. I do need some volunteers, though. And I kind of want to have some of the youth do it. Yeah. Okay. Let the three of you up here. Four. All right, Quinn, you too. I guess you could come up. Actually, come on up. We'll have some fun with this. All right, guys, gals, I mean. Thank you for coming up. You will be in the video this week. That's fun. All right, so this is a game called Would You Rather? And I'm going to give you basically two options, and you're going to have to decide which one you would rather have. And then you'll have to answer, I would rather have this, or I'd rather have this, okay? Now, here's the trick. We're going to be playing Would You Rather 1980 style, which is a little bit ironic because this is before any of you were born. All right, but in 1980, if I was to say, I'm going to offer you two things. Number one, and imagine that you are just about ready to start driving, which for some of you is not that hard to imagine, but let's say you're like 15, you've been working. I don't know, kids still get licenses. It's still a thing. You just got your license? Oh, come on. This is perfect. Okay. I'm going to offer you two options. Number one, keys. Do you have keys? Doesn't matter. I should have thought of keys to a car. A brand new car that's yours. Okay, it's paid off. It won't cost you anything. And we're talking like top of the line car. 1980. Bless you. 1980. Can you put up the picture of what it looks like? Top of the line. Chrysler New Yorker. I saw this week and I was like, can you imagine pulling up to a high school parking lot in that thing? It's like, they'll just wave you through. Sure. On through. You're always going to be looking for a guy like Tommy Two-Tone. And nobody's going to mess with you ever in that car, right? I actually think that car is it's gangster. Even today. Now, just again, we're playing 1980. It's important. The year is important. So that car, it might not look like much to you. I think it's pretty gangster, but that was a top-of-the-line car back then. Paid off, free. So that's one. I give you the key to that, or a piece of paper that's a stock certificate. Okay, this car is worth $10,000, or you could have $10,000 of stock. In other words, you own shares in a company, but it's a computer company that's similar to other computer companies in that time. And there's no guarantee. The thing could take off or it could tank. Which would you rather have? You can take either one. You just can't take them both. Chloe. Chloe's taking the car. All right, so we got one car. All right. Yes, Haven. You're taking the stock. Okay. Now, keep in mind, this is a stock for a company. There's several other companies like it out there. And there's no guarantees. So, car, stock. Okay.
It's free, so I wouldn't lose anything.
Okay. All right. Verity?
Stock.
Stock. Okay. Quinn? Stocks. All right. All right. All right, so... All right. So we got three stocks in one car. So Chloe's driving everybody to school. Ladies, I have some bad news for you that picked the stock. Oh, I'm so sorry. Let's see. Verity, you got stocks in Grid Systems Corp, which went out of business in the 1980s. So sorry. Haven, you got stock in K-Pro, that was an innovator in portable computers. They went out of business in the 90s. I'm so sorry. Well, Quinn, you got stock in a small company called Apple Corp. So, can we throw up the thing? All right. So the Apple stock, $10,000 then, $22 million today is how much it's worth. So Quinn could actually buy, you could buy yourself and 2,200 of your closest friends, Chrysler New Yorkers, that you can take home. Thank you, ladies. All right, who would have taken the car? Who would have taken the car before? Was anybody thinking like car? Yep. Okay. Some of you? Nice. Who would have taken the stock? Again, not knowing. Okay, more of you. Who's like over this analogy completely? And just which is, yeah, Mike, thank you for being honest. A couple of you guys, awesome. Very honest. I like that. All right. So I'm just going to say this. If you knew what you know now, who here is buying that car or taking that car? If you knew what you know now, and I said, you get option C, which is Apple, who's taking the car? Who's taking Apple stock? Everybody. Yeah. right? And it's sort of like, imagine if I said, well, you're going to be bumming rides. You can't touch the Apple stock for 45 years, and you're never going to own your own car until then. You're going to be bumming rides. You might even have to ride the public transport, whatever that is, buses. Would you still do it? Would anybody change their minds? Yeah. 45, you couldn't touch it for 45 years. I would guarantee that you'd still be alive, though. Right? Okay. What's the point of this little game? What do you guys think the point is in light of what Jesus is teaching? Yeah. Why might I be telling you this? We're doing what Jesus did, which is he'd tell a story, and then he'd be like, all right, figure it out. Why might I have told you that story? We know the final outcome. Yeah. Would that affect your choice today? If it was 45 years out in the future and I guaranteed you were still alive, would the final outcome make a difference to you? I see some heads nodding, yeah. Is this unanimous or is this like a, well, we're not sure? Who wants the Christ the New Yorker real bad? It is pretty gangster. It's got to be said, and if you're in high school, you got cred for days. Man, here's my point in sharing this with you guys. I'm going to phrase it in a question. Like, if you knew the future, would you reorient your present around it? Would you? What if there's millions of dollars at stake? What if you could buy everyone you know a Christ the New Yorker in 45 years? I'm just going to keep going back to that Christ the New Yorker. Is it his gangster? Man, what if I was to tell you that Jesus is trying to tell us something very similar this morning through the parable? What if I was to tell you that whatever it costs, his kingdom is worth it? That is growing in value exponentially. I recently remembered a movie that I watched when I was 14 years old called Waking Ned Divine. We got anybody in the room seen it? Yeah, a couple of you. So it was a indie film, kind of a cult classic, and it was from Ireland. Man, the things that were PG back in the 90s just so this is not an endorsement. Sometimes I say things from the front that I'm not telling you to go home and watch, or I mention things. But Waking the Divine was actually a real delight. Again, PG, 90s PG. And what it was about was this little sleepy kind of village in Ireland. There's only 52 people in the entire village. And this is they didn't have the internet, they didn't have smartphones, information was just harder to come by in this little village. But somebody got their hands on a newspaper from the outside world and found out that somebody in their village won the lottery. And so, as you might imagine, if there's 52 people in the village, you're going to want to know who it was that won that lottery, right? And so the whole movie is like, who won the lottery? Who is it? And how do we get in their good graces? Was the idea. And so you have this, it was really, really fun kind of, again, not necessarily endorsement, but really fun kind of 75-year-old, two friends that go around town trying to figure out who is it that won the lottery. We know somebody did, and we know that nobody else knows who is it. As you can imagine, winning the lottery is something that changes your relationships. It affects them in pretty significant ways. So somebody who wins the lottery may not be like, hey, I won the lottery. They may not want to tell everybody because they may not want the relationships to change. And so the whole movie is centered around this premise that they need to find out who it was that won the lottery. And now in the commercials, they give it away. So I'm not giving away, I think, anything too serious here, but Ned Divine did. And it's called Waking Ned Divine because Ned Divine was asleep forever. He was dead. Okay? So he was watching, back in the day, man, my grandparents used to do this. I don't know if this is still a thing, but people used to watch the lottery on the TV, like the little lottery balls that would pop up and then you'd get the number. Anybody remember doing this with your grandparents when you were a kid? Yeah. Some of you may still, I don't know if this is still a thing. Now it's probably just online or whatever. And so Ned Devine won the lottery, and he immediately died. His heart, he had a heart attack. Couldn't believe just how incredible his luck was. Got so excited or so scared or whatever, so overwhelmed that he just died. And so the whole movie is based around the premise that they now have to cash this ticket in or lose a fortune, which ends up being $6.7 million, which again, in 1990 dollars, a lot of money. Now it's like Thursday night at a nice restaurant. Back then, it could change the life of 52 people. And so that's the whole movie. It's really fun. They figure out it's Ned Devine, and they have to convince everybody to go in on this ruse to tell the lottery in Ireland, this is Ned Devine, one of these two older guys. So quite fun, as you can imagine. I think I'm endorsing this way too much. But the whole movie kind of explores this idea of, like, what would you give up for that fortune? These guys risked, like, prison time. It was technically a fraud. And I think what we have going on in this text is very similar. Jesus isn't saying, like, he's not making, like, an ethical claim that if you find something on somebody's property, you should bury it, buy it, so that you can get it back, and that's, like, ethically okay. The point isn't ethics. The point is the worth of the kingdom. It's the worth and the value of the kingdom. That's the lottery ticket. What would you do to secure that? What would you go through? That's what Jesus is saying. And I think what he's teaching us, if you're taking notes, is that whatever it costs, it's worth it. His kingdom. Whatever it costs to grab hold of it, to lay hold of it, it's worth it. It's like Apple stock back in 1980 when it IPO'd. If you can get your hands on one share, it's worth a lot of money. If you can get your hands on thousands of shares, it's worth millions of dollars. If you know the future, would you reorient around it? I think Jesus is inviting us to consider that. And I want you to think about your own life this morning. Think about what you have going on. Think about your schedule. Think about your priorities. Think about what matters to you. Think about the kingdom. Think about the value of knowing Jesus, the king who will one day return to earth and take his rightful place as the king of the entire cosmos. And his seat will be here on earth. He's going to reign from here. If you know the future, would you reorient your life around it? What's really going to matter then? What's not going to matter that much? Think about it. Let's dive into the merchant, verses 45 and 46. If we could throw those up, let's read them together. Again, the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant in search of fine pearls. Underline search. So the first parable Jesus tells us, happy accident. It's like finding Ned Devine's lottery ticket. That's the first parable. The second one isn't like that. It's a search. He's searching for pearls. This is a merchant. This is someone of significantly more means than the first guy, who was probably just kind of like your average worker. This is a merchant in search of fine pearls. Pearls would be something like diamonds today. Just incredibly valuable. Verse 46, when he found one priceless pearl, he went and sold everything he had and bought it. He sold everything he had and bought it. I'm going to read a quick quote. You guys don't have this in the back, to give you guys a feel for this. So unlike the peasant in verse 44, this merchant is a person of means looking for fine pearls. So back in the day, you actually had divers that would go into the ocean. They would go into the Indian Ocean, the Persian Gulf, and the Red Sea, and they would look for pearls. Okay, this would be something like diving for buried treasure, I guess, today. That's got to be a thing, right? People get in submersibles and go down, right? It's a thing. It still happens. So these were ancient divers doing similar things, but they're looking for pearls. So wealthy women in Rome wore pearls and necklaces, the most expensive of which would have cost tens of millions of dollars in today's currency. Jewish teachers actually sometimes use expensive pearls to represent the teaching of Torah. Jesus applies it to the message about his kingdom. He likens it to a priceless pearl. the message. Ancient pearl stories often emphasize the finder's piety. Jesus doesn't do that. Jesus emphasizes the value of God's kingdom and the price of grabbing hold of it. Senior in college, I was living in San Diego at USD Torero, LA, and one of the things that I was doing a lot in that time was watching soccer. And I watched it every chance I get. I watched it with friends. I had a little crew where we went abroad together. We went to Madrid, and we all came back soccer fans, rabid. And so I don't know if I was avoiding like real life. I probably should have been working my resume or looking for a job or, you know, thinking, but I was watching soccer. That's what I really cared about at that point. And I had good reason to, because I'm a Real Madrid fan. And if you don't know, Real Madrid's the greatest sports organization in the universe. I'm not going to repeat that one. I don't want to undermine my own credibility by emphasizing the Angels right now, because we're talking about a winner, which is Real Madrid. I love the Angels. And I went abroad, and Madrid was in a real trough. They had just come out. We actually studied Madrid in business school. Like, that's how great they are. We would go to we would read about them and learn about management. I did like a Harvard Business School case study. I didn't go to Harvard Business School, but we would read their stuff, and they would do stuff on Real Madrid. It was awesome. And so I knew a lot about the team. We talked about it in school when I was there, and I was like, ooh, they signed all these great players, but they play terribly together. This isn't working. They didn't have like a good system. It was just sort of like a bunch of individuals. Who knew? A bunch of superstars together, dysfunctional. And so a lot of money though, and that was the key. So when I went abroad, Real Madrid was not good. Champions with no trophies, essentially. They're like, who are we? We've like lost our way. And so when I went, it was pretty frustrating. They had tantalizing potential and did not realize it. If you ever enjoyed a team that has tantalizing potential and did not realize it, you know what this is like, Chris Taylor, Justin Shives, Angels fans everywhere. And so that's where I was. And so the next season, we would watch. There's still hope springs. There's always hope when the season starts. Am I right? We'll lay off the Angels for now. And so I was watching soccer games every weekend, every Wednesday, and loving it. And Madrid wasn't that good, which was kind of the same pattern as before. But they went on this insane run where they were winning pretty much every game and doing so in the most spectacular way possible. We're talking like 90th minute goal. If you don't know, soccer, 2 45 minute halves, 90 minutes, and then you get what's called stoppage time, which basically they add a few minutes on. It's really fascinating. Soccer doesn't count down, it goes up until the referee decides it's over. And so Real Madrid kept winning during that stoppage time, which is like 90 plus one, 90 plus two. And the most exciting, memorable, so we were just getting totally gripped. And the season was coming to an end, and I was a senior, and my parents were like, hey, have you thought about what you want for your senior gift? It was like, there's a gift? You mean you pay for this and I get a gift? I was like, you can't believe this. This is amazing. College is like a four-year vacation. For us, it was like a four-year vacation that my parents mostly paid for, and then they gave me a gift at the end. It was incredible. My hope is my kids don't have the college bug, because it's gotten just more expensive, and that's a whole other conversation for the day. But my parents were like, what do you want for college, your college gift? And I was like, I just want to finish. But if you want to give me a gift, I think I want to go to Madrid. I want to see Real Madrid win this thing. And so there were 3 weeks left in the season, and they won the third to last game. And at that point, they're tied for first. And I'm like, we're going. My brother Lewis and I, we're going to Madrid. We're gonna see these last. It's like two finals. It's like game six and game seven of the World Series. It's equivalent. And so here's the problem. I was a college kid, which meant I had no money. I also didn't love working during the school year, which meant I had even less money. I tried it once, didn't love it, didn't work. They had me making coffee, and I'm just not good with deadlines and pressure. So now I'm a pastor. 10 o'clock Sunday morning. And so anyway, so I'm talking to my brother, talking to my parents. My parents were like, hey, if you want, we could help you buy a car, we could do all these other things, but what you really want to do is go to Madrid, I guess we'll do that for you. And I was like, yes, we must go to Madrid. And so, to make a short story very long, we spent the next 3 weeks totally reorienting our lives, not around college finals, around how we're going to find tickets to these last two games, how we're going to get to Madrid, how it is that where we're going to stay, all of that stuff. Considering that we're broke, this isn't going to be easy, but we're going to do it. And so my dad, God bless him, he gave us all the airline miles that we needed. I emptied out my bank account completely. I'm sure I went into negative. Actually, I didn't. I put it all in credit cards and figured it out later. That's probably what we did. And we ended up making phone calls. If you guys remember what Skype is, we got a Skype account. We started calling random people in Madrid. It's like, hey, you got tickets? You got, ¿tiene billetes? See? No? Okay. We were just calling. We were on the, Spanish equivalent of Craigslist, if anybody remembers what Craigslist is. There was such a thing in Spain, too. It was called Pablo's Lista. I just made that up. It's not true. My brother and I reoriented our entire lives around getting to this trip. And believe it or not, we made it. We got to Madrid. I bought tickets from a Zaragoza youth fan. Zaragoza is one of the, or Zaragoza, is one of the teams in Spain. And they were hosting the second to last game. And I found somebody that basically figured out, if I sell you the ticket for this game, I'll get all of my season tickets covered. So it was the last one of the year, and so he handed me, this young guy, handed me his season ticket for the last game of the year, and my brother, his girlfriend handed my brother hers, and we spent hundreds of euros that we didn't have, which the exchange rate back then, it was a lot of money to go to this game. And we got there, we sit down, and we realize we are in a Zaragoza youth section wearing Real Madrid. So if you don't know, some of you, I think, get the gravity of this. We were in a sea of fury and anger and hatred towards us. But we didn't care. And we sat there, and it was an ugly game. Madrid always played ugly. And they were tied for first place with Barcelona. And Barcelona and Madrid were playing at the same exact time. And we didn't have smartphones. This was 2007. It was the year that iPhones came out. But we didn't have an iPhone. We didn't have the internet. We had a little flip phone that could do text messaging. And so we didn't know what was happening in that game. But what happened there and what happened here was everything. Madrid was technically in the lead because they had the tiebreaker. And so Madrid starts the game and Barca kicks off. And it's just back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, across two cities. And at one point, I think Madrid went ahead. And then Madrid gave up the goal, and then Barca tied, and then they went ahead, and Madrid went down, and Barca went up, and it's just like scoreboard watching, except we didn't have a scoreboard. So we were just kind of relying on what news filtered through the stadium about what was going on over there. But in the 89th minute, Madrid is losing and Barca is winning, which means that Barca are champions. So I'm sitting there thinking, I remember thinking, I came halfway around the world, spent every penny that I have to be here, and it's going to be for nothing. Soccer's 90 minutes, we're in the 89th minute. And Madrid just keeps putting crosses in the box. It's not connecting with anybody. And eventually in the 89th minute, which has been the whole seasonal pattern, somebody puts a cross in the box, and one of the Madrid guys just goes and just bounces it up, and it goes basically off the crossbar and back in. And so they tied. Here's the problem. Barca's winning, so it doesn't matter. So they're still down by 2 points in the 89th minute. And so we're excited. We're cheering. People start throwing things at us. So they start throwing trash at us. They start booing us, hurling insults that I won't repeat here. in another language, which I understood. I understood very well. And we didn't care. 18 seconds later, again, it's 90th minute, we're like, we're praying, God, please, let Barca give one up. And we can't, we'd have no way of knowing what's going on. 18 seconds later, I'm paying attention to the Real Madrid bench, and I see a bunch of them start going like this. They start cheering, and then I see one guy go like that, and I'm like, oh, something happened. Something happened. And then we hear, Tamudo, which is the name of one of the players that was playing against Barcelona. They had scored a goal against Barcelona, and within 18 seconds, everything changed. Madrid are back on top. And so the insults are raining down on us, trash, paper, other things I won't say were being sent our direction, but we didn't care because we walked out of that stadium and we knew we're going to win this league. We're going to be champions. And it was the most incredible feeling. That day, I can't even get into it, but that day, the series of events that actually got us to that stadium were incredible. We had to take like a high-speed train to get there on time because they switched the date of the game. They pushed it up a day. There's a thing about credit or debit card limits of like how much money you can pull out at once. And being college students, it wasn't much. And so we pulled out everything we could, and we literally had like to the last euro exactly what we needed to get home. I didn't eat that day. I didn't have money to eat. I didn't care. It was worth it. It was completely and totally worth it. What's my point? And obviously, I love talking about sports. But here's my point. As I was reflecting on this message, as I was reflecting on the merchant, Jesus, what he's teaching about the kingdom, I realized that in that moment, I gladly exchanged safety to secure a seat in that stadium. I gladly exchanged security to see something extraordinary. Whatever it cost us, it was worth it. It was worth it to be there. The insults, it was worth it. And I wouldn't change anything about what happened. I gladly exchanged money for memories. I exchanged wealth, not that we had much, but what we had, we gave to the Zaragoza youth to fund their next season tickets. I gladly exchanged wealth to be a witness. Man, it wasn't even hard. I was stoked. Do you guys know what that word means? Exceedingly happy. I have a list of a bunch of different scholars. I'm not going to read them all. But one of the things that's really fascinating about this text, Ulrich Luz, in his commentary on Matthew, when you talk about what connects these two parables to each other, it's selling. Did you guys notice that the merchant sells everything and the peasant sells everything? So this commentator highlights that in these parables, the selling is not about a forced loss or voluntary, but it's not about a forced loss, but a voluntary act of exchange made in recognition of the superior value of the treasure. This reflects the urgency and joy of obtaining the kingdom, where the person is, and this is the key word, willing to part with everything because of what they gain in return. Do you guys get it? The verb choice in the Greek actually expresses a conscious, almost instinctual response to the perceived worth of the kingdom. This is not about poverty or loss in a negative sense, but about gaining something far more valuable. This selling, it's strategic, almost like an investment. This is what the commentators say, where a person evaluates what they have and judges that the treasure or pearl is worth much more than anything else. Do you guys get it? Do you see what I'm saying? The decision to sell all the possessions, it's not an obligation. It's not based on obligation. It's a realization of the surpassing value of the kingdom. It's worth it. Whatever it costs, it's worth it. Can you guys throw up the quote from Philippians? Some of you, this is going to remind you of something you've read in Scripture before. This is the Apostle Paul in Philippians. He says, everything that was a gain to me, I have considered to be a loss because of Christ. This is the Apostle Paul. This is a guy who was a Hebrew of Hebrews. He was trained. He was a scholar. He was zealous for the traditions that he had received. This guy was thug life with Judaism. And then he had an encounter with Jesus, and he's like, I'm leaving all that. Don't press that too far. He was still Jewish. He saw the Jewish scriptures, but he recognized there was something greater. Jesus. I consider everything to be a loss, and that's a very kind translation. It's a little rougher than that. It's more like rubbish. Use your imagination. It's not a nice word. I consider everything to be a loss in view of the surpassing value of knowing Christ Jesus, my Lord. Because of him, I have suffered the loss of all things and consider them as dung. Actually, that's the word, dung, not loss. That's the one that's not polite. Slightly explicit language in the Bible, it's there. Consider it as dung, so that I may gain Christ. I don't think Paul's just trying to be edgy just for edginess' sake. I think he's trying to make a point that compared to Jesus, it's all so that I may gain Christ and be found in him, not having a righteousness of my own from the law, but one that is through faith in Christ Jesus. Do you guys see it? Whatever it costs, it's worth it. I just have one question for you today. Do you believe Jesus is worth losing everything for? Do you believe that today? And is it a joy? Notice, it was a joy. Again, it's not obligation, it's not duty, it's not a checklist. I think sometimes in our relationships, marriage isn't the be-all, end-all, so I'm going to use a marriage analogy, but this could apply in other areas of life. But, you know, sometimes marriage, you start off a certain way, and then it can become kind of like duty. And you can lose that joy. I wonder if there's some of us in this room that have lost the joy of being the bride of Christ. And maybe for you, it's just duty is what you feel. It feels like a checkbox. It feels like a list. And right now, like maybe you're paying the price, but you're not experiencing the joy. I think Jesus has you on his heart today. And I think he wants to refresh your joy, give you a renewed sense of it. Some of you, you may be here and you're like, I never experienced that joy, bro. It's like, okay. Maybe you haven't. Have you experienced that instinctual joy that this story talks about? Maybe you haven't. And I would just suggest to you that it's possible that you've just not seen the face of Jesus yet. You're like, well, what does that mean? What do you think the face of Jesus looks like? How would you describe him? Besides Jonathan Rumi and The Chosen. Like, what are his, he's great. That's who I think of when I, doesn't matter. What's he like? He's gracious. He's kind. He's merciful. He knows what it's like to be human. He knows what it's like to experience loss. He knows what it's like to experience betrayal. He knows what it's like to have insults rain down on him. He knows what it's like to go through life and be misunderstood. Like, that's what Jesus is like. Have you ever experienced him in a way that leads to instinctual joy, that you can't even help it? I'm not here suggesting that you should conjure this up. If this isn't something you've experienced, don't fake it. This is not a fake it till you make it. That's not a thing in Christianity. God's interested in reality. He lives in truth. That said, guys, there's joy. During that trip, when I went to go see Real Madrid, I think I ate baguettes 90% of the time. Except for that one day where I just couldn't eat anything. We didn't have a euro to spare until the next day. I wasn't hungry. We slept in hostels, which you've never slept in a hostel before. Don't. You don't know what you're going to wake up to. You don't know what's going to be gone. You don't know who's going to be there next to you. Just don't do it. Although if you're young, it's kind of a rite of passage, so you might need to do it in order to travel. My point is, I didn't care. It was worth it. 100% pure, unadulterated joy. Fun. I had a seat in an extraordinary party. Yes, they rained insults down on me. Yes, they had choice words to say about me because I was a Madrid fan. Yes, it was a little lonely and isolating to be the only person in the whole section cheering. Don't care. Worth it. Man, what does this passage teach us about the king and his kingdom? Will you guys throw that up? Or Everett, would you mind throwing that up? This is the big idea. If you've taken notes, write this down. Sit with this week. The series we're in is called The King and His Kingdom. All these messages teach us something about the king and his kingdom. Here's what this passage teaches us today. If you grasp the worth of the king, you'll gladly exchange the lesser things for the greater things, or for the greater thing, or for the greater one. What's Jesus worth to you? Whatever he asks of you, it's worth it. I'm going to invite you to stand. I'm going to call the band up. Stretch it out. We're doing well on time. If you knew the future, would you reorient your present around it? My choices, my priorities reveal my values, what I care about, what I think is important. My calendar tells me more about my commitment than my charisma. That doesn't make sense. Sometimes preachers get on these alliteration tangents. That's a dud. Where is it? I'll let you decide. But my calendar is really important. And it tells you something. What's on your calendar? What are your priorities? What do they reveal? Do they reveal a joyful prioritizing of the kingdom above all else? If you grasp the value and the worth of the king, you'll gladly forsake all to grab hold of it. And I want you to know, this is really important, that Jesus doesn't call you to do anything he hasn't already done for you. Jesus left the comfort of heaven in order to embrace a covenant that would lead to his death. That was signed in his blood. And he didn't do that to like rub it in our face. He did it to reveal his love and to secure our salvation. He thought you were worth it as his bride to embrace discomfort. Jesus relinquished safety. Think about his life. He was in danger all the time. If you watch The Chosen, which I recommend just for the sake of visual, I'm a visual learner. One of the things that stood out to me, something that I've read in the scriptures that just never jumped out, but that Jesus went from one dangerous situation to another, to another, to another, to another. He was never safe. He was a marked man, marked by the Gentiles and the Jewish leaders for death, marked by God for salvation, for ours. He left safety behind so he could secure a seat. Not just a seat for himself at the right hand of God, but for you and me to have a seat at the dinner table of the Lamb, at the marriage supper of the Lamb. Jesus, he's not asking you to do anything he hasn't done himself. He's valued the kingdom above all else. He offered his life in exchange for yours, and now he gives you his life, and he asks you to give him your life back to him. If you grasp the worth of the king, you'll gladly exchange the lesser things for the greater. Is there anything in your life right now that might be a lesser thing that you're holding on to that may make it difficult, if not impossible, to grab hold of the greater thing or the greater one? Is there a grievance? Is it your reputation? It's saving face. Is it a concern about what people will think of you if you ... that thing that Jesus is asking? Is it a concern of what it'll cost you to press into the assignment Jesus put on your life? What is it for you? I just want to encourage you. He's offering you a joyful exchange of something lesser for something greater, himself. Today, Restored San Diego has its first gathering. From uptown to San Diego, we'll keep this brief, but my wife Heather and I were there at the beginning. And the reason that we're here is because we had an opportunity to come up here to help start a new community after we had been in San Diego for several years. And as I was chewing on the message, as I was chewing on the things that Jesus has called me to do in my life, the great exchanges that he's invited me to, that was one of the greatest. To leave a community where we were established to help establish this one. I wouldn't change anything. We're about to celebrate 7 years. It's incredible. It's been worth the price. Jesus' assignments are worth the price. And so I want to encourage you guys. Some of you in this room are actually called to do that. Maybe not move to a new community, but it could be that. But I have this feeling, and some of you in this room, you were called to gladly exchange being established so that others can be established in this place or in other places. You guys know what I'm saying? To embrace discomfort, maybe to give up your seat so someone else can have it, and go to be the first one to sit at a new table to invite others to sit at it. Yes, I'm talking about multiplication. Some of you, that might be the thing for you in this season. What is it? Whatever it costs, it's worth it. Jesus, I want to thank you for this morning. And there's so many people in the room. There's so much that we could talk about. I'm just going to leave it here. Would you apply the message into the hearts of every young person, man, woman in this room? Would you help them to see what you're calling them to uniquely? And I pray that it would be rooted and grounded in a deep sense of joy because, Jesus, you've already given yourself. You've already exchanged your life for ours. That's the great exchange. And if we see that for what it's worth, if we grasp the value and the worth of the King, we'll gladly release lesser things to grab hold of the greater one. Would you help us to see that this is a gracious call that leads to the freedom that you want for us? I pray for instinctual joy to permeate our lives. Thank you. We love you, Father. In your name we pray. Amen. I'm going to call the prayer team up to the front. I'm going to invite you guys to respond in a couple different ways. Number one, we got time to praise Jesus this morning. One of the ways that we express joy is just by song. Another way that you can respond is by coming up and getting prayer. Maybe you're here and you're realizing like, hey, that second the merchant was searching. And maybe you're here and you've been searching in the wrong places, seeking fulfillment in different ways, through wealth, through pleasure, through power, through fame, through approval, through control, through an enemy, I don't know. Yet never finding it in those places because those places are not meant, those things are not meant to fulfill us in an ultimate way. And I love this. When, by God's gracious guidance, we find the kingdom, when we find that treasure, when we find that priceless pearl, we realize that it is what we've been looking for all along. And so if you recognize this morning that you have been searching and not finding, come and receive from the one who wants to reveal himself to you. If you are struggling in any way this morning, even if you're just struggling to see Jesus for who he is, come up and get prayer. So we're going to go in time of response, and then we'll be back up here in a little bit to close.